We are live, folks. Welcome to episode 3575 of the Survival Podcast. Today is Wednesday, October the 29th, and we're bringing back to the show, for I think like the third or fourth time at least, Professor C.J. Kilmer, who from the Dangerous History Podcast. We're going to be talking to him today about kind of a theme that's been running this week, like blood and guts of what's going on and what we could see coming soon to this country. And it may be even sooner than he thought with some of the things going on right now with the government shutdown and SNAP being shut down. I'm sure we'll get into that too. But this is just kind of what we've been this week, right in the center of this, the blood and guts, fire and brimstone world. And you know what? You guys like that. So we'll talk about that for another day this week. We're going to be talking about, though, is how when we look at conflict in the United States and we talk about like a second civil war or whatever, what everybody does is look back to the 1860s. Very clear lines, North and South, Mason-Dixon line, very concise list of issues and grievances from both sides. Modern warfare for the time, standing armies fighting each other until the war is over. Yeah, that almost never happens. Okay, that is, like when a country melts down, that is seldom totally the exception. When we look at the United States today and the type of grievances that people have, including many of the people that have them are, I'm going to say, mentally insane. I think a much better model, and this is what CJ wants to talk about today, is the troubles in Ireland, where the enemy could be the person that lives next door to you or across the street from you. And the warfare methods were far from conventional. It's classic urban guerrilla warfare and terrorism. Is that what's coming to America? I believe it is. I think CJ does. I don't necessarily know that it'll be completely everywhere all the time. And that's not how that works anyway. I would say we're already there. I hope I'm not stealing too much of CJ's thunder, but I would say if you look at some of the things going on in Portland and Chicago, we're kind of there already. It was just a matter of how far do we go down this road before there's some sort of rectification. So that's what we're going to be talking about today, an uncertain future for sure. With that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors before I bring CJ on. First up today, John Pugliano and the Wealth Studying Podcast is where you should go to learn to grow your wealth like you grow a garden. John is a independent investment manager, and he's a very, very good one. And he also runs the Wealth Studying Podcast, where he tells you what he's doing with his clients' money about once a week and why he has the strategy that he does. The podcasts are generally fairly short, running in the range of 10 to 15 minutes long. Definitely worth a listening, and you should check him out at wealthstudying.com. And guys, remember, John's one of us. He's a prepper. He's not just a financial guy, right? He, you know, has the garden, has the stored up food. He's a ham radio operator. He's a gun guy. He's one of us, you know, the old thing, one of us, one of us. Anyway, the next sponsor of the day today is JM Bullion. I am a huge, huge Bitcoin bull. I think that is where the majority of your surplus capital should get parked for the foreseeable future, definitely. But if you looked at silver and gold pricing lately, it's more than doubled in a few years. And it's because it's not so much that the gold or silver itself is really worth more in some ways. It's also a lot to do with the value of the dollar going down. We say in Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin has no top because fiat has no bottom. That applies to assets like gold and silver as well. But if you're going to stack gold and silver, where should you get it? JM Bullion. Why? Because they've been sponsoring this show since 2012. Get a calendar out. Look how long that's been. 2012, we've had these guys. I know the CEO personally. They do a discount for MSB members. All orders ship free, and they have better pricing than Monex and Atmex. So my question for you would be, why would you ever, and I mean ever, get your gold and silver from anybody but JM Bullion? With that, I want to bring CJ on, but I want to play a little bit of intro music today. And after I bring CJ on, we'll tell you why we had this particular selection for it. It will probably demonetize me, but I'm okay with being demonetized today. So here we go. Intro music for Professor CJ today.
Slowly take care to the passed silence. Who are we mistaken? Many you see, it's not me, it's not my family. In your head, they are fighting with their tanks and their bombs and their bombs and their guns. In your head, they are crying. In your head, in your head, zombie, 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 hey, hey. What's in your head? In your head, zombie, 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 hey, 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 oh.
And with that, let's bring CJ on and let's fire up the conversation here. For those of you who are not familiar with the genesis of that song, it has to do with what we're talking about today, the Troubles in Ireland. My understanding, it was the Cranberries put it out after some killings that were kind of after the Troubles were supposed to be over, hence the whole in your head. You're still fighting something that's over. But there's a line in that we never got to because I didn't want to, you know, turn this into a jam session fully. But it's the same old theme since 1916, and I bet CJ might have a word or two on that particular year as we get into this. But with that, hey, CJ, welcome. That's the first musical intro for a guest in a very long time. Welcome to the show, man.
Well, thanks, Jack. It's always good to talk to you, and I'm honored to be brought in with some good music.
Yeah, yeah, it is a good song, but like I said, I think a lot of people don't really understand where it's from. It's in a lot of social media crap today. That's what made me think of it when I saw your topic. Before we get into what went on in Ireland and where it really heated up in like the 60s and 70s, and I remember this as a kid being like a big issue, who is CJ Kilmer, and how did you end up where you are in the world today, which is doing this crazy-ass podcast? You're like an ex-academic, I guess, is an ex-member of academia, not an ex-academic.
Yeah, yeah. So I refer to myself as a recovering academic in the same way that someone would say I'm a recovering addict, which I am too, but that's a side note. But I, born and raised a Florida man, actually, have lived originally from Miami, but have lived a long time up in Northeast Florida. I know you lived in Jacksonville for a while, so I'm just a little bit south of that. I went to college because that's what you're supposed to do, and I got good, you know, grades despite not caring or trying very hard, and good test scores and all that. So I went, and I didn't know what to do, so I said, I like history. I'd been reading books about history without anyone having to tell me to do it since I was, like, in, you know, fifth grade or something, because I discovered real history books. So I got a bachelor's degree in history. I went on to graduate school for history. I got a master's degree, but I quit graduate school before I got a PhD for a number of reasons, some of them kind of personal and family, and some of them just I was sick of being in graduate school. Then I'm looking around to try and find a job where, you know, I can at least make a living and whatever with a history degree, which isn't the easiest thing to do, especially if you don't have a PhD. But after adjuncting for a year at a couple of different colleges, I got on at a community college up here in North Florida, and I taught history there for 15 years full time, and then finally just couldn't take it anymore in 2022, and I walked away. And you know, I've got all kinds of complaints about academia that, you know, I'm sure you and probably most or all of your audience would be familiar with. I've also got some, like, from an insider's perspective too, that are, you know, things people didn't know about, at least not until recently. Way back in 2014, I started my show, The Dangerous History Podcast, and the name comes from a H.L. Mencken quote, something like, "The most dangerous man is to any government is the man who is able to think things out for himself, et cetera, et cetera." So that was what I was thinking when I said dangerous. Mm-hmm. And I started that in 2014 as just sort of like a sort of experiment, turned into a little side hustle and eventually grew from there. By the way, one of the podcasts that inspired me to do it myself was Survival Podcast. I only had to listen to you for about 5 years before I finally got off my ass and started my own thing. And I was probably thinking about it for at least four before then. So for 11 years, I've been podcasting about all kinds of history stuff. And, you know, even though I went through the academic mill grinder, I kind of kept my own independent brain. And so my show is like history, but from a, you know, just to make it super short, like a Ron Paul point of view, basically. You know, I'm kind of an old school Ron Pauler in that sense, you know, never bought into the Trump thing or whatever, but I'm just always very skeptical of power. I'm always very skeptical of wars, all that kind of stuff. So I've covered all kinds of topics over the years, more American history than anything, but I've covered other stuff too here and there, done big series on the Civil War. Some of your listeners who are familiar with me might know I've been doing a detailed dissection of Woodrow Wilson that I've been working on for probably like 5 years at this point.
The best thing that man ever did was die.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's like whenever somebody says like this is the worst president ever, I'm like, you know the thing from Lord of the Rings, like, but what about Second Breakfast, right? We talked about Woodrow Wilson, right? Which is not what we're going to do today, but there's some definite validity to that.
For sure, for sure. And I'll throw in for today's topic in particular, I do actually have some particular expertise in Irish history, including Northern Irish history and all that. When I was in graduate school, my primary field of study was British Empire. And obviously, Ireland is a big part of that story. And I took one of the things I took when I was in graduate school was an independent study course with my advisor, who was a very good history professor specializing in UK, you know, history. Yeah. And so we went into Irish history, like in so much detail and all that. And then when I was teaching at the community college, I actually got to lead study abroad trips with one of my friends who was a literature professor and taught Irish literature. And so on three occasions, we led groups of young yahoos across the ocean to Ireland, and each time we spent 10 days there. So I've spent a total of 1 month of my life actually in Ireland, and we traveled all over the country, including into the north a bit, you know, north, south, east, and west, all over the place. And, you know, it was awesome because I already knew, you know, all the history and everything. So I really got more out of it than almost anybody else. But, you know, as Douglas Murray famously said, I have been, to Northern Ireland anyway. And I'll say that studying, you know, modern Irish history, especially the stuff we're going to talk about today, it totally changed my perspective on a lot of things. Yeah. It totally changed my perspective on how I look at the Israel-Palestine thing. At the time, I was in grad school like 03 to 06, I think.
Yeah.
And at the time, you know, was peak George W. Bush War on Terror, and studying the Irish Troubles changed my thinking on a lot of that stuff too. And then just in general, as the U.S. domestic, you know, police state has just grown and grown and grown since then, again, what I know about the Northern Irish Troubles has, you know, made me have a different perspective on it than most, you know, commentators and stuff.
Yeah, let's get stuck into it, as I would say, on the conflict itself. Mm-hmm. This conflict went back about 400 years, and even though it was a religious, you know, Protestant Catholic thing, there was enough world history tied into it that I remember studying some things about it when I was in high school, and this was still going on. I was in high school, a little older than CJ, not by about 10 years, I think. Yeah. And so this was still more a thing. Like, there were even like exchange student programs bringing like Protestant Irish kids over to hang out with Catholic families here to try to help diffuse the angst back in Ireland going on when I was a kid, you know. But even in the times when I wasn't in Catholic school, because I got thrown out twice, and so I went from like Catholic school to public school, back to Catholic school, back to public school. Even at public school, we talked about this conflict and its roots with things like the Church of England and stuff like that. But it really freaking, you know, like I said, they dropped that date of 1916 in the song there, but it was the 60s and 70s when this thing went freaking parabolic. So what made that such an inflection point?
Yeah, so Ireland was partitioned after World War I. There was what they call the War of Irish Independence, which was kind of kicked off by the Easter Rising, which I actually did a podcast episode on a long time ago, either right before or right after I went to Ireland for the first time. And it was put down with brute force by the British, but then, as often happens, you know, when you put down an insurrection with excessive force, it tends to actually make a lot more people suddenly sympathetic to the rebels who previously might have seen them as like, hey, these are, you know, crazy extremists, troublemakers, whatever. But then, you know, when the UK cracks down, it turns nasty. Then you had an ongoing civil war for a few years after World War I ended. This is the Michael Collins era. If people have ever seen that film with Liam Neeson, that gives you at least a decent, you know, it's fairly historically accurate overall. There's another great one worth watching called The Wind That Shakes the Barley that has to do also with the Civil War that followed. But anyway, long story short, the British had a problem, which was, I think a lot of the British elite by, you know, say the early 1920s would have been fine just walking away from Ireland as more trouble than it was worth. But the problem was in the northern six counties of Ireland, or the northeastern six counties of Ireland, there was a Protestant majority. You know, there's a Catholic majority, pretty big one for the island as a whole. But just in that northeastern corner, there's a Protestant majority, and they very much wanted to stay part of the UK. And they were willing to use, you know, force to do so. On the other side, you had the Republicans who wanted Ireland to be a unified, independent republic, who were just as vehement about their point of view. And so what the British government ended up doing was to just partition it and say, all right, most of the island gets to be, it kind of happened in stages, but ultimately it became an independent republic by the mid 20th century. And the northeastern part, though, stayed part of the UK. And what happened was that the Northern Irish, you know, six counties, they kind of had their own independent government, but not quite as independent as, say, like Canada or Australia would have been at the time within the British Commonwealth, but somewhat independent. The problem was that the Protestant majority in the North, as my advisor told me back in grad school, he said the Protestants, after partition, they turned their majority into a monopoly. What I mean by that is, they really just took over all of the important, offices of state having to do with running the Northern Irish government. And they were very blatant about, discriminating against Catholics. And it was an even bigger deal then and there than it would be in, say, the U.S. today, because, you know, it's part of the U.K., so it's even more socialistic than we are. So that means the government has a huge amount of influence on who gets access to good housing, who gets access to, like, what, you know, resources. It was a very poor part of Europe at the time, and so, you know, a lot of people needed various types of welfare state programs, or, you know, at least had become dependent on them. And again, it was all being, you know, pushed in favor of the Protestants. In addition to that, the Northern Irish police were, you know, dominated by Protestant, like overwhelmingly Protestant. And so it didn't reflect the fact that, you know, it was maybe like a 60-40 Protestant majority in the overall population at the time, but like almost no, police were Catholics. So it was really blatantly discriminatory in almost the same extreme as like the old South, you know, between Reconstruction and the civil rights era. And so in the late 1960s, there was a peaceful, civil rights movement that arose on behalf of Catholics. And it was very like self-consciously inspired by and modeled after the American, like Martin Luther King, nonviolent, you know, peaceful protest, civil disobedience stuff. And they were trying to just get basic, you know, equality for Catholics in terms of like jobs, because again, it's a fairly socialistic place at the time. So like a lot of jobs are government jobs. So, you know, Catholics were disproportionately poor, disproportionately shut out of the better paying jobs, disproportionately shut out of access to good housing, like all these legitimate grievances. Interestingly, there actually were some Protestants who were part of this. They tended to be sort of more like left-wing Protestants, but they were just fair-minded people. Even some of the leaders of the Northern Irish Civil Rights Association, I think it was called at the time, even some of the leaders were actually Protestants, but they were just like, hey, this is wrong. You know, we need to have basic equality. Now, the hardcore, what would be called unionists and loyalists, which are like the, you know, we want to stay in the UK no matter what. And also, we don't want to allow the Catholics to have, you know, any kind of a say in anything. They obviously were vehemently opposed to this. And there started to be some marches, again, very similar to like Martin Luther King style marches and things, just saying, hey, we want equal treatment and all that. And the most extreme Protestants are known as loyalists. And they started to violently like fight with the civil rights groups.
Because, Irish people fighting in the streets? No.
Exactly.
No.
Yeah. and so there started to be kind of like irregular riot type violence a little bit. And this culminated in what becomes known as Bloody Sunday. So Bloody Sunday is January 30th, 1972. And this is the incident that inspired the famous U2 song that most people know, but, you know, a lot of people don't really know. Like with Zombie, a lot of people don't really know, you know, what's behind the song. But on Bloody Sunday, there was a massive peaceful protest in what Catholics would call Derry and what the Protestants would call Londonderry, which was still is a city in Northern Ireland that's actually got, I think, a majority Catholic population in the city or in the immediate area. And it was actually led by a member of the British Parliament who was like a left-wing Protestant who sympathized with the civil rights movement. And there were British soldiers who had been deployed to Northern Ireland within the last like year or two, ostensibly like, hey, we're just there to be neutral and keep order and keep the violence down. But everybody kind of knew that the British troops, you know, sympathized with the unionist, loyalist, Protestant side of things. And basically there was a massacre where a bunch of British paratroopers ended up opening fire on peaceful, unarmed marchers and killed like 13, 14 people and wounded at least as many, if not, you know, quite a bit more. And this was just a huge, you know, igniting event for the Republicans, the, you know, more extreme Catholic side that wanted Northern Ireland to be joined with the rest of Ireland in a republic. So there's a great film made in, I want to say 2002, something like that, early 2000s, that depicts this massacre, this incident, in a very accurate and honest, straightforward way. And it's really well done. It's, I think it's just called Bloody Sunday. And anyone who's interested in this, I'd recommend watching that film. One of the things that happened in the immediate aftermath of Bloody Sunday was a lot of Irish Catholics saw it as, well, we tried. We tried the peaceful route, and look what they did. They just started shooting at unarmed, you know, peaceful protesters, so we can't try that anymore. And the IRA, which had been like, it had been around since the Irish independence movement in the early 20th century, but it had been kind of languishing to a fair amount for a while, because things prior to the late 60s had been, you know, the Catholics were getting screwed over, but it had been kind of like, you know, not a lot of violence directly or whatever. So the IRA had become kind of a shadow of what it had been. And yet, you know, as anyone with common sense would expect, in the aftermath of Bloody Sunday, all of a sudden recruitment for the IRA skyrocketed. All of a sudden, people who, you know, before Bloody Sunday really hadn't thought much of the IRA and all that, suddenly they're now like banging down the door saying, where do I sign up? In the same way that, you know, whenever the Israeli government does something horrible, it ups recruitment for, you know, the groups that oppose them. Whenever the US government does something horrible in some part of the world, you know, it probably is going to lead to blowback sooner or later. And so from there, it just started to escalate. And you had this very complicated situation where, you know, we look at it as Americans, and if we even know anything about this conflict at all, we think it's a two-sided conflict. There's Protestants and Catholics. But it's more complicated than that, because there's different factions within each of those. And then there's also like the UK government itself. And then there's also the government of the Republic of Ireland, the rest of the island, which, you know, had involvement in a whole bunch of ways during the entire thing. Also, by the way, one of the things that happened in the aftermath of Bloody Sunday was that even in the South, even in the Republic of Ireland, recruitment for the IRA suddenly skyrocketed, with a lot more people interested in using violence to get revenge as they saw it. And people who maybe before would have been satisfied with just getting equality under the law and civil rights and things, now were like, you know what? No, we want a fully independent, unified Ireland, and that's it. We're willing to, you know, fight to the last man for it. And on the other side, the opposite extreme, the loyalists were like, no, we're never going to allow Northern Ireland to be part of the rest of Ireland, and we're going to keep the Protestant, you know, dominance of everything come hell or high water, and we're willing to fight to the last man to do it. So the violence just escalates from there, and it's often described as things like irregular warfare, asymmetric conflict, low intensity conflict, like this.
Yeah.
It's not a high body count thing. We might even say that this conflict was mostly peaceful. Because, you know,
it actually might have been more peaceful than some of the damn riots we've had over here in some ways.
Yeah.
I mean, really. Here's what I've always wondered about this, and I've never really gotten a great answer to it. The whole Protestant Catholic thing, it had to have a much more political connotation than the differences between the faiths. Everywhere else in the world, Protestants and Catholics live in complete peace with each other. The Methodist Church, the Anglican Church, the Lutheran Church, and the Catholic Church on the same street.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's throwing freaking Molotov cocktails through a stained glass window at all.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with plenty of kids around me. I was a Catholic family, Baptist, Methodist, you know, Unitarian, whatever. No problem. Mm-hmm. Ireland, like, to me, there had to be much more of the socioeconomic status. And that was like, the religion was more of an identifying characteristic of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's sometimes described as an ethno-nationalist conflict, and maybe nationalist is the best way to describe it. You know, I think that definitely the religious split started the whole thing, you know, going back to the 16 and 1700s. Like, I think, you know, the parties to the conflict back then were like, you know, that was their primary motive, and it really was a big deal. Like, are we loyal to the Catholic Church, or are we loyal to the Church of England, and for the Scots-Irish, the Presbyterian Church? But yeah, I mean, by the time you get into the 20th century, it's not, you know, that they're fighting so much about, like, do we believe in the doctrine of papal infallibility?
Yeah.
How do we interpret scripture or something like that? And it's more like, yeah, you've, if you're the Catholics, you're like, oh, you've been, you know, screwing us over for hundreds of years, and we want our independence. And if you're the Protestants, you know, they had their line too. They had their propaganda, which was like, well, the Catholics are all a bunch of terrorists, and, including the civilians, and you can't trust them. And they're loyal to, you know, the Pope and not to the UK government like we are.
And so,
the religion thing, now it never really goes away. And throughout the entire time period, church attendance and intensity of religiosity on both sides were higher in Northern Ireland than they were in the rest of the UK or in most other parts of Europe.
Yeah.
So it's like the one place in Europe where in the 20th century you had like really thriving, like evangelical Christianity was Northern Ireland, where they had preachers who are, you know, in some ways like reminiscent of American, you know, evangelical preachers.
Right.
And, you know, they're able to connect it to this whole narrative of the Catholics or these, you know, they're all a bunch of terrorists. And if they ever succeed in joining our six counties with the rest of Ireland, we're just going to be outvoted by the Catholic majority and everything's going to go to hell in a handbasket and, you know, all that stuff, which you could tell was totally true because, you know, Southern Ireland is obviously like one of the worst hellholes in earth now. Right. Mm. Oh, well, wait, it's actually, you know, one of the nicer countries in Europe, in terms of like standard of living and whatever. So yeah, actually the Catholics did. It took them a while to figure it out, but the Catholics eventually did okay governing the rest of Ireland.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's probably also like, because of the length, like there was probably a lot of bad blood there anyway.
Yeah.
Right. Because there'd been so long. So that was rooted in kind of religious history. So then you've got blood feuds going, right? You've got good old fashioned, you know, basically Hatfield and McCoy type dynamics going on inside of this. And then when you get conflict and you have those like familiar or clan feuds already there, well, now you got cover to go out and do what you always wanted to do, you know? And I think there was probably some of that too. And the reason I bring that up is we're trying to create an analogy to what we're looking at in America today. And boy, howdy, does that sound familiar, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And, most of the fighting that took place was like smaller scale, you know, almost what would look like gang warfare, really, where it's like, you know, a sniper shoots a few people. You know, there's incidents where like people knew, like in a given city, which neighborhoods are all Catholic and which neighborhoods are all Protestant. Like they were segregated and everybody kind of knew. And so, you know, if like a, let's say a Catholic, paramilitary group, the IRA or one of the other splinters of it, you know, let's say they went and blew something up in a Protestant neighborhood. Well, you know, then those Protestants are going to tit for tat, you know, they're going to say, oh, let's go blow up something in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
And they also had their pubs, you know, the Irish Protestant and Catholic love their pubs, love their beer and whiskey. And again, like everybody knew, like which were the Catholic pubs and the Protestant pubs. And so they would attack each other there sometimes too. There would be, you know, someone would just barge into the other side's bar and just shoot some people or throw a little bomb or whatever. So it's low casualty, overall, although since it's a very small country, the percentages are actually kind of significant. But, on an average year during the heyday of the Troubles from, say, the early 70s through the late 90s when it finally started to wind down, the average death count, counting, you know, all sides and all factions, was around 100, around 100 people, you know, which doesn't sound like much. But again, it's a much, you know, smaller country than ours by orders of magnitude. I'm trying to remember it. I might have jotted it down. Let's see. So when you look at the overall death toll of the Troubles, widely accepted estimate is around 3,500 people, maybe a little bit more. Now, that's over the course of like three decades. So, again, we're at like 100-ish a year, something like that. But given the population of Northern Ireland at the time, a conflict of the same intensity in the U.S., if it lasted as long, would result in over 500,000 people getting killed. So it's kind of complicated because, you know, it's not like the U.S. Civil War where, you know, there's clearly defined, you know, groups with uniforms. And yeah, there was some irregular warfare in the Civil War, but it was, you know, relatively small on the fringes.
Yeah.
And it's also not the same where it's like, you know, lots of killing from big battles that are happening relatively, you know, frequently and regularly. Instead, it's mostly these small scale things. You know, British troops shoot a couple of people in a Catholic neighborhood who they say are terrorists and the Catholics say no. And then back and forth, there's snipers, you know, on both sides. There's people, you know, doing bombs and all this sort of stuff. And so it's smaller scale. And again, you know, it's similar to what we're seeing in the U.S. recently and what unfortunately is likely to happen going forward if there's not some, you know, dramatic deus ex machina to sort of, you know, get everybody to calm down.
So can you explain kind of maybe what things really looked like for people? Like what would a typical day, because let's say typical day where something happens look like, because there were days where nothing, there were a lot of days where nothing happened, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, and that's typical of all conflict, like even a civil war, like the war of 1860s here, or World War One, or like there's always like this incredible boredom between absolute horror. But this is mm-hmm. way different because this is like these small skirmishes, basically. Mm-hmm. But when there was a dust up, what mm-hmm. did that look like?
Yeah, so it would usually be on the nationalist side, you know, the side of the IRA. They actually would most of the time target British security forces, because in their sort of narrative, the ultimate enemy is always, you know, the UK government in London. And so they targeted them, the majority of their attacks, but they would also target kind of their opposite number on the other side, which would be, loyalist paramilitary. So these are Protestant, kind of like the Protestant equivalent of the IRA. They're not, you know, conventional armies, but, you know, they're fairly well trained and equipped. And they had sort of a complicated relationship with the UK government, sort of dependent on who was running the UK government at any given year. They would, you know, sometimes be pretty cooperative with the loyalists and sometimes not. So most of the fighting is happening either between groups of like irregular forces or between irregulars on the Catholic side against British, you know, military and police on the other side. And the way to think about it is probably something similar to if you lived in a really bad inner city neighborhood in a major American city during a major gang war. But just imagine the gang war goes on for 30 plus years. Mm. Okay. And it never turns into like, you know, people like leveling each other's neighborhoods or massacring each other by the hundreds or anything like that. But instead it's these things where like, you know, a couple of IRA guys go out and, you know, set up a bomb because they know that a British patrol, you know, a little armored vehicle with some British paratroopers in it or whatever is going to come through that neighborhood. And so they set up a bomb to hit it or something like this. Or they set up a sniper to shoot a couple of British troops on their way back to the barracks or something like this. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, you know, the loyalists would do similar things against IRA people. They would try to assassinate leaders, and sometimes succeeded. You know, both sides engaged in that sort of thing. And then the British would oftentimes do things, and many of them they denied at the time, but later get confirmed. The British government at various times did all sorts of things that, you know, should be like even under their system, like totally out of bounds in terms of especially with special forces groups like the SAS and some of the British intelligence agencies. Things like just killing people, extrajudicial killings, where, you know, they would just send in the SAS to just assassinate some suspected IRA leaders or something like this, not even make an effort to arrest them or whatever. And so the British government during the height of the Troubles threw out a lot of the basics of like what we would think of as Bill of Rights type stuff. So, you know, it's messy gang war. It's irregular kind of guerrilla type warfare. And it's also, you know, propaganda and psychological warfare, too. Each side had their political wings who were kind of like kind of compartmentalized from the violent wings. So in the case of the IRA, famously, you have the IRA, which is paramilitary nationalists avowedly using violence. And then you had Sinn Féin, which was the political wing that, you know, their official line was we're separate from the IRA, but were sympathetic to their cause. Now, in reality, you know, they were coordinated and everything, but they weren't, you know, working together day to day. And so, you know, Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness and some of these other Sinn Féin leaders, their role was, you know, I'm the guy in a suit who wants to come on TV and tell you why the Irish Catholics are angry about what the Brits are doing, you know, that sort of thing. So you also had propaganda and psychological warfare happening on both sides. And a lot of the things that we associate in our country with kind of like post 9/11 war on terror, and then, you know, ever since, all the stuff about, oh, this is to catch domestic extremists and whatever. A lot of that stuff the British were doing all the way back from the 70s through the 90s in terms of, interning people without charges or trial for indefinite amounts of time. They would just go like round up, you know, what they said were IRA suspected terrorists or whatever. And I'm sure sometimes they were, but a lot of times they weren't. A lot of times it would be mistaken identity. There's actually a book or a movie, another good one related to this, with Daniel Day-Lewis called In the Name of the Father, that is about a guy who, case of mistaken identity, just gets nabbed by the British and taken to, like, you know, a secret prison. And, you know, a lot of times these guys who were interned, they would be tortured, things like this. A lot of this has come out. Since, again, British government at the time typically vehemently denied it. Oh, we don't arrest people, you know, without charges or trial and take them off to secret prisons to torture them. It turns out, yeah, actually they did.
Yeah, we kind of do that. Yeah. But it's the really bad guys when we do it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And the British, authorities during this, they also engaged in lots of censorship. They would oftentimes like censor the Catholic point of view on anything, the nationalist point of view on anything. For a long time, I don't think they would even let, Gerry Adams, the spokesman for, you know, the political wing of the nationalist movement, they wouldn't even let him speak on television, for a long time. And then, they had some kind of goofy rule for a while where they would let Gerry Adams speak on television, but they wouldn't allow his actual voice to be played. And so it would be video of him speaking and then like some goofy voice that didn't match him at all. And it's like, come on, guys. You're just trying to make him look ridiculous. You're just trying to make him, okay, yeah, we're going to let you say what you want to say, but we're going to make you look like, you know, a complete joke, while you're doing it. So, you know, censorship, unlawful internment, surveillance, enhanced interrogation, like all this kind of stuff became standard operating procedure very quickly in the Troubles. In addition to all of the irregular back and forth, almost kind of like gang style warfare. But there were also the high level attacks. There was a big one in the 80s where the IRA bombed Harrods department store in London, and killed a fair number of people. You had, in the late 70s, I want to say it was 79, Lord Mountbatten, who was a royal, was closely related to the royal family. He was assassinated by an IRA bomb planted on his yacht while he was on vacation. Margaret Thatcher was almost killed. The IRA, a few years later, early 80s, I think, the IRA bombed a hotel in England where the Conservative Party was having their, you know, party meeting for the year or the election or whatever. They bombed it and did kill some people, but not Margaret Thatcher. So, you know, there were high level, the IRA attacked Downing Street, the prime minister's mm-hmm. residence, in the early 90s with mortars. Trying to kill, by that point, it was John Major, not Margaret Thatcher, who was prime minister.
And they knew they couldn't go toe-to-toe with the British military, but they also seemed to be very aware of the fact that the real center of who they were in conflict with was London, not the other side of the street. There was plenty of conflict up there, too, but they were very well aware that their real problems lied in the federal government of the United Kingdom.
Yeah. Now, there's interesting stats about the body count of the overall conflict. Like, you know, not only who killed who killed how many, but also who killed what, you know? And so the Republicans, you know, the kind of Catholic nationalist side, they killed more people than the other side. What's interesting though, is that, they're the only faction. So sort of like the three factions when it comes to the fighting are the Republican paramilitaries like the IRA, the Loyalist paramilitaries, and there was a variety of those, but they're sort of like the you know, pro-UK equivalent of the IRA. And then you have the British security forces that are, you know, British Army and also like British, you know, Northern Irish police. The Republicans killed more people overall than the other two groups combined. But the Republicans were the only group where the majority of those they killed were actually enemy soldiers. Majority of what they killed were like British security forces, soldiers and police. And interestingly, the other two factions that are kind of both on the other side, even though they're sort of separate, the Loyalist paramilitaries and the British security forces, both of them, they killed fewer people overall, but both of them, majority of what they killed were civilians. So, you know, it shows you that these things are messy, that none of these groups, you know, all these groups did horrible things that I would never endorse. But interestingly, the hard evidence does seem to suggest that the IRA and kind of their side did do a better job of, like, targeting enemy soldiers more often, and things like that. But they would be very choosy about it. You know, they wouldn't say, like, yes, let's get a platoon of IRA and, like, go toe to toe with a platoon of British, you know, soldiers, because they knew
they couldn't.
Yeah, yeah.
They couldn't. It's me and Mike Tyson in the ring. Like, I'm going to die. Right? Even as old as he is now, I'm going to die. Like, it's not going to happen. You know?
Yeah, yeah. So instead, they use, like, classic kind of guerrilla moves of going after, like, small, isolated British military facilities, or catching British, you know, little small groups on patrol through Catholic neighborhoods, ambushing them or hitting them with IEDs or whatever. But yeah, and again, the whole time, you know, most days there was no significant violence anywhere in Northern Ireland. Or if there was, it would be like, you know, something that killed a couple people, maybe injured a couple people. But imagine what it would have been like for a person just growing up there. And let's just say you don't really want any part of this conflict. You're like, you know, a kid or a young adult. And let's say, like, you don't even really want to be in this. You'd rather just, like, you know, like most people, have a decent job and start a family and a decent life or whatever. And you're growing up in this environment where, regardless of what side you're on, every time you step out of your house, there's a possibility that, like, a bomb might go off, you know, as you're just walking down the street.
Yeah.
Or you go to the pub and, you know, somebody from the other faction decides to throw a bomb in there that day or something like this. And so the violence doesn't have to be that frequent or that large scale for it to have a massive psychological effect. And again, especially on young people. And, you know, imagine you're a young man in Northern Ireland and you're a Catholic, but, like, you just don't want to be involved in the violence. And then let's say, you know, someone really close to you who, you know, your father, your brother, someone you know is not any kind of a terrorist or paramilitary, gets killed or gets disappeared, right? And, you know, you have reason to suspect he's been taken to a secret prison to be tortured. Or let's say you yourself, as often happened, you yourself are just walking down the street, and you're a Catholic in a Catholic neighborhood, but you're not a violent person or anything. You just want to be left alone. And let's say British, you know, SAS or intelligence just grabs you and throws you in prison for an indefinite amount of time and tortures you, and then eventually says, oh yeah, we got the wrong guy. You fit someone else's description. Or oops, we had a faulty tip. Turns out you're actually innocent. All right, let's send you home. And you know, maybe you weren't a violent extremist before, but I bet you after, like, an SAS officer crushes your testicles and waterboards you and whatever, I bet you now you're like, okay, where's the nearest IRA recruiting hangout? I want to go blow shit up and kill people because fuck these people, quite frankly.
Yeah, I mean, and there's just a psychological effect there, and I don't think people realized how deep that was. I had a good friend who was in the British military in the 80s and 90s, but his unit that he served in was the main unit at Bloody Sunday in 72. Now, this guy's a little older than me, but not much. He was in diapers during Bloody Sunday, right? He said he would never let anyone know that he served in that unit, because even at that point, and I was friends with this guy in, like, the early 2000s, he's like, they'll kill me. They'll kill my kids. Right? Now, would they do it or not? I don't know. But that was the psychological impact on people. Here, this guy's living in London. He was in this unit, but he was in this unit decade and a half after this thing happened. And at that point, if you were known to be in that unit, you were like an open target. Still. And, you know, that's kind of the in-your-head zombie thing. Like, it was kind of over by then, but there's some people still freaking pissed off, right? And, like, it's not over for them. You know, so the Japanese guy on the island in 1948, he's still fighting the war.
And a lot of times, you know, there's that personal beef aspect that you've mentioned before. A lot of times, like, you know, somebody on one side might be like, you know, overall, all right, Good Friday Agreement. All right. Overall, I don't want to do violence anymore. But there's this one SOB on the other side who did something to me or did something to a close friend or family member. And so, yeah, you know, I don't want to fight the UK government anymore, but I'm going to go kill that guy because, you know, what he did to me or someone I care about, I can't forgive. And so, yeah, that's part of the kind of like smaller scale thing, things that have happened since the Good Friday Accords in the late 90s. Also, some of the violence that's happened since, you know, peace mostly came has been tied into the parades, what's called the marching season in Northern Ireland, where the Orange side, which is the Protestant side, they have these elaborate parades to commemorate the Protestant victories back in like the 1600s and so forth. And to the Catholics, it's the equivalent of like if, you know, what was Custer's unit, the 7th Cavalry? It'd be like if the 7th Cavalry like marched right through the Lakota, you know, reservation to commemorate the massacres against the Lakota and all that sort of stuff. Like, imagine how offensive that would be. That's how the Catholics see it. And so there's been some, like, you know, street violence. I don't think too much really recently, but definitely in like the early 2000s, there was street violence and a lot of controversy because the Protestants saw, and they would deliberately, the Protestants would deliberately march through Catholic neighborhoods as a way to, like, you know, piss on the other guy's territory and say, like, ha ha, we're still dominating. Yeah. And so there was controversy where when they were making peace in the late 90s, you know, the Catholics were like, hey, can you just, like, not do your marches in our neighborhoods and right in our face? Like, can you just do it in your neighborhood and just, like, you know, kind of leave us alone? And the more extreme Protestants were like, no, you know, we absolutely have a right to march right down your street carrying, you know, things that, you know, again, would be like marching through the Lakota reservation, you know, cheering about the massacre at Wounded Knee or something like this. So there's been some violence having to do with that.
You know, the Union troops marching through Savannah, but only like 5 years after it was burned.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, you know, to celebrate that, like that's what was going on there. And I think people have a hard time really understanding that. You kind of return that corner, though, of where we came to what you'd call like a relative peace.
Yeah.
I would call it more like a violence reduction, because like you were saying, there's still shit popping off here and there, but it was way different, and it was generally accepted that we're kind of done with this now. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? What so dramatically reduced it by the turn of the century? Did the U.S. have anything to do with it? Because I had someone on the show 4 or 5 years ago. They grew up in Ireland, and I had no idea that anybody even thought this way, but they told me that during this time, they were always afraid they would see US F-16s come over the horizon. I'm like, well, I don't know where you guys got that idea from, because that wasn't even on our radar of that. But like, what was it that kind of shut that down?
Yeah. Well, there had been some different efforts to try and get, peace talks going, but they didn't really get much of anywhere for quite a long time. And a lot of it was just people being sticks in the mud on both sides. So, you know, the more extreme Protestants, the loyalists, their view was like the Catholics, the nationalists, they're all like terrorist monsters. And so how can we negotiate with them? How can we have any kind of reasonable talks with someone who's just like a murderous monster? Does this sound familiar? Right. You know, in whether it's in Israel and Palestine or whether it's in, you know, the U.S. today, you know, how can we talk with the other side? They're Nazis. How can we talk with the other side? They're, you know, communists or whatever. And so, like, you couldn't even literally get the leaders of both sides in a room together for decades. And then little things started to, you know, happen over the course of the 80s here and there that kind of, you know, started to improve certain things. Now, the violence was still going on the whole time. But one of the things that was helpful to the peace process was that the government of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, they kind of stopped officially saying, like, we want a united Ireland and, you know, basically, like, we kind of side with the IRA. And instead they adopted more of a, you know, approach of like, we just want there to like be peace and harmony and whatever, you know, so that helped. But I'll give Bill Clinton credit. You know, every now and then he did something okay.
Yep.
When he wasn't flying around with Epstein or doing Waco or whatever, but, you know, he kind of took the Ireland peace process seriously as something he wanted to, you know, involve himself in as an actual neutral arbiter, not in the way the U.S. typically does in regard to Israel, where they're not neutral at all. And so he had Gerry Adams, the head of Sinn Féin, the political arm of the IRA, had him, you know, come visit the U.S. and the White House in his first term. And to, you know, the Protestants, it was like, oh, my God, the American president is throwing us under the bus. But, you know, he wasn't even really siding with them. He was more just saying, like, hey, we've kind of got to talk to, you know, one of the lessons I learned from studying this conflict that when I was in graduate school is that if you have this kind of conflict happening, one of these messy, irregular conflicts where each side is calling the other side terrorists and, you know, with some justification in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
Is that if you ever want to just have peace, you have to be willing to negotiate with terrorists.
Huh.
Or with people that you see as terrorists. Now they see themselves as freedom fighters and, you know, valiant resistance and whatever.
Potentially,
but
essentially, it's the terrorist thing. Is that your word? If you want peace, right, and you're at conflict with the other side, then you must actually talk to the other side to end up at peace because you can't, right? I mean, this is not the Borg. Like, it's not either be assimilated or die. Okay, then we're not talking, but these are other people. We can have a dialogue with them. And before you answer that real quick, just if you came in mid-show or whatever – and the title didn't make any sense. When I set up the stream today, I used a template. I didn't change the title. So I changed the title, but if you're in it and you haven't reloaded it, it'll still say yesterday's title. Today's show is got a totally different name, and it's Blood in the Streets, History Repeats. That's what we're talking about today. So I apologize for the mislabel. But, yeah, you have to talk to the other side.
Yeah, and it was really tough. Like, the more mainstream groups on either side – you know, by my late 80s, early 90s, we're kind of willing to talk with each other. But you had the, you know, the more extreme groups. So you had the Sinn Féin, you know, Republican nationalist side. And they were like, you know, we see the other side as a bunch of, you know, terrorist oppressors and all this. So, you know, yeah, we're willing to negotiate as soon as you're willing to, like, you know, give in to most of our demands. And then on the other side, the more extreme unionists and loyalists, and their kind of like equivalent leader was this Protestant preacher named Ian Paisley, who was like super hardcore. He sounds like the way you would hear a Southern preacher, you know, ranting against quote unquote Negroes in like the 1920s or something like this, is how this guy would talk about Catholics in Ireland in the 70s and 80s.
Gotcha.
And his view was like, yeah, you're all a bunch of terrorist murderers. And so I'm never going to sit down in a room with you unless you first agree to all my demands, you know? And for a while, the UK government was more on that side. For a while, the UK government was like, yeah, we'll negotiate with the IRA as soon as they completely disarm and all that. And, you know, from their perspective, they might see it as like, yeah, we can't have talks unless there's no violence. But from the IRA's perspective, it's like the British government wasn't even interested in talking to us at all, except for the fact that we are actually pretty effective, you know, at fighting them and resisting them. And so, wait, you're asking us to give up the only card we have before we walk into the negotiations. And again, it reminds me, you know, I don't want to get sidetracked too much into it, but, you know, kind of reminds me of like the Netanyahu line and the American, you know, sycophants for him, where they're like, yeah, we'll negotiate with the Palestinians as soon as, you know, they completely disarm and basically preemptively agree to all of our demands, then we'll have negotiations. And that's how Americans often
but there won't be any negotiating at that point because you got nothing left to negotiate with.
Yeah. So Clinton, you know, started the process. Eventually, American Senator George Mitchell got involved, and he really played an important role in bringing the parties together. And they worked out a deal that, you know, resulted in the main paramilitary groups on both sides disarming over the early 2000s. Now, splinter extreme, ultra extreme groups on both sides, you know, some of them did keep their weapons and did occasionally do some violent things. But like the main IRA you know, eventually did disarm. But again, after they got what they considered a reasonable deal for things like major, you know, reforms, Northern Ireland had its government suspended pretty quickly after Bloody Sunday, where their somewhat independent government was kind of like put on hold, and the UK kind of took it over directly for much of the years of the Troubles. And so, you know, the Good Friday Accords in, I think it was 98, that George Mitchell played a huge role in, and so did the Southern, you know, Republic of Ireland government. It involved a kind of an elaborate political compromise where the Catholics would be guaranteed, you know, certain rights, like for real, and would be guaranteed a certain amount of you know, posts in government, a certain amount of, you know, numbers and leadership roles within the new Northern Irish police force, and like all these kind of like basic compromise things. And, you know, is it perfect? No. Is everybody happy with it? No. That's like a compromise means nobody got all of what they wanted, but it was enough of a compromise that, you know, most of the violent groups on both sides did, you know, decommission, disarm, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, when I was up there, up in the north, and we went to, spent a little bit of time in Belfast. We also, spent just a few hours, but a little bit of time in Derry, where Bloody Sunday and a lot of other important events of the Troubles happened. And, you do still see, you know, evidence of it here and there. And talking to the people is very interesting. The Irish in general, they know their history very well. Even in the South, like they can, a lot of them can just, you know, random guys, not history majors in Ireland, a lot of them can just like rattle off, you know, the Battle of the Boyne or something like that that happened in the 1600s, you know, or rant about how you know, Oliver Cromwell and William of Orange are like two of the biggest bastards in history, you know.
Yeah.
And in the North, it's like, especially an older person, it's in their living memory.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we went to, in Belfast, we went to basically an IRA museum, which was interesting. Hmm. It was like kind of shoddy little hole in the wall place. I guess they didn't have much funding. But like, you know, you'd go and there'd be like, I'm assuming, you know, disabled, like bombs in a glass case. Like, this is the kind of bomb that, you know, we used to blow this up. Or, you know, there'd be like a Tommy gun, you know, like,
yeah,
few places in the UK where you can like see a Tommy gun right in front of you, but it's, yeah, you know, probably disabled. But, yeah, it was really kind of just kind of interesting because it was mostly old people who were running it. And you could tell just by how they talked about things that in their head, it's like, they're not sure this peace is going to last, you know, mm-hmm. And for sure they're still nursing all kinds of grievances and all kinds of PTSD.
And then at one point you bring all this up, because what I'm thinking is like, what I remember about like my uncles and my father with Vietnam conflict, they didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. My grandparents really didn't talk about World War II. If you asked, they would tell you just enough to shut you up. But they went to war. The war happened over there and they came home. And I'm betting if you were a young kid in post World War II Germany and you had relatives who fought in the war, or in England and had relatives who just lived through the bombing of London, I'm betting there was a lot more dialogue about what actually happened because you were where it happened. It wasn't somewhere else. I've never really thought about that dynamic, because almost every war that the United States fought wasn't here.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the only time we really fought a war really here was the Revolutionary War, which is way past any living memory, and the Civil War, which is also way past any living memory. There's been some little things here and there, but we've never had a full on freaking conflict on American soil. So we have never had that cultural connection to the history behind the conflict where, like you said, people just rattle it off and know it because it's part of the culture. Like, I can tell you all about how cattle were moved from down by San Antonio up to Fort Worth because I live here. And if you live here, you probably know that. But we don't know the history of our own conflicts because the conflicts were elsewhere.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the one, you know, kind of, instance in America where there is a lot of that, not exactly living memory, but not that long ago, are, you know, some of the Indian reservations, with the tribes, the nations that, you know, experience like large scale warfare there. You know, some of the larger like Lakota reservations and things like this. You know, I haven't spent a lot of time in and around those, but my sense is that they have more kind of like the Irish where they're more likely to really know, because, you know, this massacre maybe happened to like my great grandfather, and it happened like a mile over that way, just on the other side of that hill, you know, and, yeah. And there's still a monument to the, you know, the cavalry unit or the local militia unit that did it. And so again, there's more of that like visceral connection, that, yeah, you don't have. I mean, you know, some American vets did eventually like go back to Iwo Jima or go back to Normandy or whatever, but, it's not the same where like every day you're walking by it. And in the case of, you know, of Northern Ireland, it's such a small country. I mean, the whole island of Ireland, counting the Republic too, is like the size of South Carolina, I think, and has fewer people. Mm. And the northeastern six counties, you know, known as Ulster or Northern Ireland, it's just a little fraction of that. And so, like, if you're living almost anywhere in Northern Ireland, there probably was at least some degree of violence of some sort that took place in and around your neighborhood. Like, you might be going to hang out at your local pub where five people got killed by a bombing in the 80s. Mm. And there might still be, like, you know, scars on the wall that they didn't want to fix because they wanted to leave it there as a reminder kind of thing. And I had some experiences like that in a couple of pubs in Northern Ireland where, you know, again, it's like it's on the back burner. But if you just talk to an older, you know, local, and, you know, you have to be careful how you talk about it, of course. You know, you don't want to seem like you're taking the other side or being judgmental or anything. You have to come at it more from like a perspective of curiosity. Like, you know, hey, you know, I'm a visiting American. I'm a history professor. I've studied a lot of your country's history, and like, I'm genuinely interested. Like, what was it like? And how do you feel now? Yeah. And I had some very interesting conversations where you could tell, like, most people that I talked to were very happy that the violence was done.
Yeah.
Did not want it to come back, but there was still like some degree of grievance, you could tell, and still some degree of uneasiness will this, you know, peace endure? At the time I was there, a lot of Catholic Northern Irish people were concerned about Brexit because they felt like Northern Ireland had been kind of like secure for them, for kind of the Catholic side, because it was within the EU, that like the EU sort of guaranteed a lot of their rights and made sure that the British didn't come back in and start playing dirty pool. Mm-hmm. And they were worried, you know, how's that going to happen? Including, you know, the Republic of Ireland stayed in the EU, still is in the EU. One of the things that came out of the peace agreements in the late 90s was basically opening the borders between Ireland and Northern Ireland. Prior to the Good Friday Accords, it was, you know, not quite as bad as going like between Israeli and Palestinian territory, but it was definitely like.
But it wasn't U.S. and Canada.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been even more like, you know, tense and intense than going through like the Mexico U.S. You know, border in a car. And I think you needed to show a passport, and like they had, you know, they might search your car just cause. And now you go and driving from Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, into the Northern Ireland, which is still part of the U.K., it's really no different than driving from Florida into Georgia. Okay. There's a sign, but like there's no checkpoint. No one stops you. And so, you know, a lot of the people in Northern Ireland on the Catholic side, when I was there, they were concerned, you know, is that agreement going to break down if the UK is not part of the EU? Now that it didn't end up happening, you know, the border's still open and it's still, you know, free to travel back and forth and whatever. But like things like that, you could tell, talking to just random regular people in the pub or on the street, you know, that it's still fresh in their minds. But there's a lot of effects people don't think about. You know, imagine like growing up, let's say, especially if you're a kid or a young person, when the troubles really get started, you're growing up in this environment where on any given day, you might just be grabbed by the police and dragged off to a dungeon to be tortured. You might get killed, whether you're part of anything or not. You might get killed by a bomb or a bullet, or your friends might get killed. And yeah, most days nothing violent happens, but every now and then it's serious. And what that does to your psychology, you know, giving you like really deep PTSD. And then also, Northern Ireland was already, you know, one of the poorer parts of the UK when this all started, and it got worse because
if conflict does not make the economy better, but yeah, that's not.
Yeah. Unless you're making like guns and caskets.
Somewhere else and shipping it in. That is great. It's picks and shovels to the miners. If they die in the hole, you don't care.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And think about it. Like, who wants to invest? Like, let's say, you know, a business is looking to invest in a Western European country. Like, who wants to invest in a place where there's irregular warfare happening?
Yeah.
Not much. You know, DeLorean tried with his car company and that didn't work out, you know?
Yeah.
But that was for other reasons, but still. So like throughout the Troubles, unemployment was like at what we would consider depression levels. It was worse amongst the Catholics, but even amongst the Protestants, it was high. And also, there's a lot of evidence to show that things like alcoholism and other forms of addiction went up. Things like divorce went up, illegitimate out-of-wedlock childbirths, other evidence of just like social morality. Because when you're living in a war zone, even if it's one of these quote-unquote low-intensity war zones, there is sort of a sense of like, I could die tomorrow, even if I'm not doing anything, you know, stupid or aggressive or anything. And so people have much more of a low time high time preference. I always forget which is which. High time preference, right? And so, like, yeah, if you might get randomly killed tomorrow walking to the grocery store, you're more likely to, you know, do things like drink, do drugs, you know, have random sex, things like this. So something like this, it causes poverty, and it also causes an increase in virtually every major kind of like negative social dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And again, divorce, child abuse, you know, depression. They had, I think, the highest suicide rate in the UK for much of the time. And I believe they still, I could be wrong about this, but I think I remember reading somewhere that Northern Ireland still has a significantly higher suicide rate than the rest of the UK, which all things we think of when we think about like soldiers with PTSD who came back from, you know, nasty stuff in Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever. And a lot of these people are just civilians. A lot of them are people who were never really part of any, you know, terrorist group on either side, but just lived amongst it. And so, you know, you have to think about the costs of conflict like this. Like, it's not just this many people died, this many people injured. It's also like way more people, you know, damaged in these less obvious but still very real ways from this conflict happening and dragging on and on and on.
So let's kind of talk about some ways this applies to us. I look at our country and I don't see the same cause at all, but I see a lot of parallels. Mm-hmm. I also see a much bigger country, a country that is extensively armed, a lot of bad blood, a lot of anger, and a lot of clans, right? Not like the McGregor clan, right? Like, not like that, but we've got like some really strong feelings towards certain things. It's odd. As bad as, like, a lot of times the things you see on social media don't seem like they're really that bad in real life. But, like, some of the crazy stuff around the whole trans stuff, go to Seattle like I did. This is the most important thing in these people's lives, right? They'll die on the hill. So sometimes the social media makes things look worse than they are. And sometimes, like, it's actually worse than you think it is. And yet, even there, you'll find a lot of people that don't want to go along with that. Or pick one of 20 other issues, then look at the economics of the situation right now. We got 42 million Americans on SNAP, 42 million, right? And I did a show yesterday. I don't know if you saw anything about it, but like one of the things I explained is like if I'm Walmart and I hire you, I literally have a rep in the store that when you get hired, one of the things they do as part of your intake is they help you fill out your SNAP shit, right? So they hire you, and then they get you on food stamps, and then you buy your food from Walmart. But here's the calculus on it. They don't – everybody thinks Walmart pays like $5 an hour or some stupid shit. They don't. Walmart's minimum wage nationally starting is $14 an hour. But what they do is they give the person part-time hours. That keeps their income below the threshold, and it would work out like I give you 28 hours, and I pay you $15 an hour. Okay. Do this math. 12 hours at $15 an hour. Right? What is that? It's 10 times 50, 150 plus 180 bucks. Okay. But you get $800 in SNAP if I don't give you the hours.
Mm.
Well, what are you going to do? Right. Then you buy the food from Walmart. Okay. And then you buy the food that makes you sick from Walmart. Then you get on Medicaid. And then you buy your drugs at the Walmart pharmacy while you work at Walmart, and Pfizer profits. And then you pull that plug out. Well, this is bigger than just the person that was getting the benefit being pissed off. This is a whole economic hit on top of it. Right. And okay, this stupid shutdown will end. Who knows how much fire it'll kick up first. But that program's vulnerable. Right. And we can't keep growing it forever. 42 million people. It's basically one in five people. Bro, when I look at all of those things together, that's just one thing. Then the whole conflict between people who I think are legitimately mentally insane and people who want some level of sanity. But you've also got the uber conservatives that just there's nothing conservative about them, but they think they are. I mean, on both sides. And I just see like. Can we not end up with maybe something far worse than this? I mean, I look at this and go, this is a good thing to look at because we can really understand it well. But I feel like we can have a hell of a lot more Bosnia-Herzegovina in this country maybe than the Irish Troubles.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the similarities, I think, to what is starting to happen and unfortunately where things could go, you know, that you've got this messy kind of low-intensity conflict that kind of waxes and wanes and kind of tit for tat escalates for a while, then calms down maybe for a little bit and whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a much larger country. I mean, you know, even all of Ireland combined is smaller, in land and people than many American states. I mean,
yeah.
The entire island has less than half as many people as my state, Florida, in it. Mm. And the North is, you know, a minority percentage of that. And it's less diverse, right? You had two main factions overall. You know, they weren't all totally united on, you know, methods or goals even, but like, you know, you had basically two sides, the kind of more Protestant / UK side and the more Catholic / you know, nationalist Republic side. Whereas, like you said, here, it's so much more diverse in every sense of the word. You know, we have so many more, you know, different regional subcultures and so many more like weird, islands, like, you know, blue cities in red states and usually it's not red cities, but like red counties in blue states, like those more rural right wing counties that are in parts of California and the Central Valley or, mm-hmm. or upstate New York or things like this, where it's like, it's a totally different country in terms of the culture and the politics, but it's still under, you know, the rural right wing upstate New York counties are still governed by Albany and New York City, essentially. California, you know, you've got those rural right wing counties where it's like that would be a red state if it was a state. And then you've got, you know, Austin in Texas and some of these other cities where it's like it's a very red state. And then there's like one county, usually with one big city in it, that's like super left wing, you know, almost Portland level.
Mm-hmm.
And so that makes it complicated even more so. In Northern Ireland, like, yeah, you know, they were kind of mixed in together and whatever, but there were often, like I said, sort of neighborhoods that like everybody kind of knew, whether it was really official or not, like, yeah, this is a nationalist neighborhood. Don't be going in there wearing your I love the UK t-shirt, you know. It was kind of more, you know, you could know, you know, it didn't always save you, but most of the time you could kind of know like where to go, where to not go. Here it's messier like that. And yeah, big one is we're better armed. You know, we have a lot more guns relative to our population than they did. They had more than the rest of the UK for sure. But,
yeah.
Especially after the violence was rocking for a few years, but, you know, we're much better armed. And even if you instituted draconian gun control tomorrow, that's not going to eliminate the hundreds of millions of guns everybody's got already.
No.
And then we've also got, too, something that people don't talk about, I don't think, as much as it deserves to, that because we've been fighting these nonstop messy wars overseas for, you know, basically a little over half of my lifetime, for, you know, 25 years on a large scale, we've got tons of veterans, and, you know, some of them have psychological issues, some of them don't. Most of them, you know, tend to lean right, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. There are, and have been, you know, hard left-wingers in the military. So we've got a large veteran population, you know, people who have been trained to do these things, and many of whom have firsthand experience in actual combat in all these places around the world. And, you know, I'm not going to go with our government and say like every veteran should be treated as a, you know, likely terrorist or whatever. Of course not. But, you know, whether for justifiable reasons or unjustifiable reasons, we probably have a much higher percentage of our population who are like combat military veterans. And if things started to escalate, you know, enough of those people are gonna decide, again, maybe for very good reasons, maybe not, to get involved. And when you've got, you know, people with that level of training and experience in their background, and they decide, all right, you know, it's go time. You know, we've tried pushing our side and our views, you know, through the political process and through peaceful means, and it's not working. So to hell with it. You know, we've had some sparking incidents, obviously, over the last few years. We've had a bunch, you know, we've had everything from the Kyle Rittenhouse thing, the various Black Lives Matter, you know, police killings, and then the resultant riots. And then obviously, Charlie Kirk, was a huge, you know, precipitating event. We haven't really had something like Bloody Sunday, which again, you know, to us, that would have to be an incident proportionate to our population as a country where hundreds of people get massacred. Thankfully, we have not had anything like that, but it could happen. You know, I hope and pray it doesn't, but it could happen today, you know, while we're talking. It could happen tomorrow or next week. You know, it could be a real thing of just some genuine extremist decide to do something horrible. It could be a case of American, you know, troops or law enforcement shooting at people they shouldn't be shooting at. Maybe shooting at people that they needed to shoot at, but it looks bad. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know,
which, by the way, I think is exactly what they're trying to do with these ICE protests, where they're blocking the entries, throwing shit at the officers, all that shit. And I don't think the people in the street know that that's what is being done with them. I think they think they're fighting the good fight and they're standing up for freedom. And I think that they believe in what they're doing. But I think the people that are pulling the strings are like, look at the useful idiots. Let's see if we can get some of them shot. That will further our agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you can get something to cascade, like think of like Kent State, but it didn't stop at a few shots.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, think of that. And there's high potential for it, because if you have some other actors that are out in that group, and when the shooting starts, they start just popping off their ghetto bangers. Right. Then that keeps that cycle running, and you can end up in a really bad state. And it takes one guy running around with a camera with 20 dudes laying on the ground bleeding.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another, you know, important major difference is just time. Like, most of the violence in Northern Ireland wrapped up by the turn of the century, you know, but by 2000, most of it was done with. And it's just been, you know, sporadic little things off and on, you know, every now and then since, but not very often. So that means that the troubles took place pre-internet, basically. Cause like late 90s, like, yeah, we were going on AOL and sending an email, but that was about it. There's no social media. No one's walking around with a smartphone. It's not like today where literally everybody has a camera and a video camera in their pocket at all times. And, no social media and all that. There's not like open access to, you know, video editing software that's virtually free.
Yes.
So between the internet, social media, smartphones, all these sorts of things, the propaganda and psychological war is way more important and way more potentially powerful than
the power of artificial editing with AI or just the ease of editing that we have today. Here's an example that just happened. And this isn't picking up for Trump or anything. It's just what happened. So what's her name? The blonde chick, his secretary, his press secretary. She's asked a question about renovations at the White House. Right. So she's asked basically, are these other renovations happening too? Plus the ballroom? Like what's the and what she says is, well, right now the president's number one priority is the ballroom as to White House renovations. So the media just cuts off the very end of it. So right now, President Trump's primary, you know, his number one priority is the ballroom. So now it's like a let them eat cake moment for Marie Antoinette, right? Like, so, you know, screw Ukraine. Don't worry about peace in the Middle East. Don't worry about the Asian summit. Don't worry about the government shutdown. The president's number one priority is the ballroom.
Yeah.
And then freaking fat ass Pritzker goes on TV and repeats it. Now, that's from like the corporate media apparatus. There's so many opportunities to do shit like that and sow discord. And that's a weapon. And this is what you know. If combatants in a war have access to a weapon, the weapon will be used.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a weapon. And people don't understand that that's a weapon and what can be done with it. Because there are people that will – you can show them the whole thing. They still won't believe it. They'll say that's the alteration. We still hear about the bloodbath bullshit, right? Like this kind of crap. And don't think both sides don't do it. It's just the left is so disconcerned with anything even looking like it is moral and ethically right that they're more obvious when they're doing it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even think back to, you know, Trump's good people on both sides comment, which was, you know, edited and framed as if he was, you know, saying like that the actual, you know, crazy Nazis and whatever are great.
Crazy with torches, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and if you actually watch the unedited clip, it's pretty clear he's not saying that. He was saying there were, you know, well-intentioned people on both sides of just the debate over do we take the statue down. But how many, like, you know, potentially violent, useful idiot Antifa people still to this day believe that Trump was like endorsing the Tiki Torch guys and like they now see themselves as, because yeah, if you genuinely believe that Hitler is about to take over your government and start, you know, instituting a final solution against people like you, like, yeah, you know, isn't violence justified to stop that? Yeah.
What would you do?
Yeah. Yeah. So another difference that is kind of interesting. I mean, it's potentially very, very dangerous, but is just interesting as a history guy is, that the factionalism even within the government. So like in the case of Northern Ireland, you had the UK government that was trying to pose as we're like the neutral mediators, just trying to, you know, get the violence down. In reality, they weren't, but within the British government, just like with ours, it's not one unified thing. There's factions. And so when there were kind of more left-leaning governments in London, you know, the Labour Party and affiliated, you know, kind of social democrat parties, center-left parties, they were generally, you know, more sympathetic. Like, they weren't rooting for the IRA, but they were, like, much more serious about, hey, let's have a fair, you know, deal and try to get both sides to negotiate and whatever. And but you had, you know, not just the conservatives in parliament who were opposing any real efforts for decades to negotiate with the IRA and Sinn Féin. You also had, just like in our, you know, system, you had, you know, career civil servants, bureaucrats, military officers, and perhaps most important of all to this stuff, intelligence officers. And so you might have, let's say, a Labour Party government in London that is serious about, hey, let's negotiate and try and throw some bones to the Catholics so that we can just get the violence to calm down. And they might be undermined by their own intelligence agencies because they have a deep state just like we do. And so, you know, you might have the prime minister really trying to make a peace deal and some, you know, ultra secret intelligence agencies, you know, decides like, nah, we don't want that. We want this thing to keep going because it's kind of cool for us. And, you know, people start profiting off it in various ways and playing both sides and all that stuff. And so, you know, you might have a case where, you know, they stage a false flag in order to prevent peace talks from happening. Or they just go, they have, you know, SAS commandos just go shoot up a bunch of Catholics that they say are IRA leaders, knowing that that's going to just derail the peace process. Does any of this sound familiar, again, to both our own country and also Israel-Palestine, for that matter?
Yeah.
And just that messiness, like the U.S. government really isn't one thing. And so, you know, you might have Trump, who's kind of more sympathetic to the kind of right-wing side of the current, you know, controversies. But he's the president, and he's able to appoint his people, you know, to be like the head of the agencies. But does that mean everybody in the CIA is still, you know, is now a Trump supporter? No. Does it mean everybody in the FBI is still a Trump supporter? No, et cetera, yeah, et cetera, for all the other agencies. And so it's complicated, you know, even more so than the Northern Ireland conflict in that way, where you could have a situation where, you know, the president and maybe some of the kind of agencies and things are on one side of the conflict, unofficially, of course, or at least, you know, more sympathetic to that side. And yet a lot of the career kind of like middle and lower level people are actually more sympathetic to the other side and don't always do what the president wants them to do, as we've seen many times in regard to Trump. And so that adds this other wild card factor, you know. What happens if, like, as happened with that whole Russiagate thing, you know, that was like a whole op from within the FBI, from high-level people, career people in the FBI did that, try to frame the president for treason, yeah, treason with, yeah, Russia instead of with Israel, like he should have. But, you know, what happens if those same people, you know, decide to stage a agent provocateur or false flag op that's like a bigger deal than January 6th, and the president doesn't even know about it, you know, and Trump's so easy to lead around. What if they actually convince Trump that, you know, some future even bigger fake January 6th type thing, they actually convince Trump like, no, that was a legit attempt to overthrow the government. He might decide to crack down on what we think of as his own side, you know?
Yeah.
So, and with any war, but maybe even more so with what we think of as like civil wars and insurgencies and things like this, war is a Pandora's box of chaos. And when you open it, it never goes the way anyone expects or intends it to. You know, the enemy gets a vote, Murphy's Law happens, mistakes happen, people act in ways that you don't expect them to, all kinds of things. And there's always unforeseen, you know, side effects on society. And so, like, just in general, this is why I'm always very kind of like instinctively anti-war. But like, you just don't know where it's going to go. Once you open up that Pandora's box, you don't know where it's going to go. One place you can almost always bet your money it's going to go is, regardless of who kind of like wins or who has the upper hand or how it all ends, you're going to lose a lot of your prosperity and a lot of your civil liberties in the process.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Yeah. I think that we have some real potential for this problem to overlap with something I had you on the show, I guess about a year ago about, which is collapse of empire.
Mm.
Like one of the things I said yesterday when we were talking about this whole thing with the welfare state, and basically yesterday's show was the concept that, again, all welfare is corporate welfare, because the true beneficiary of spending is whoever accumulates assets at the end, right? The poor and middle class don't buy assets, right? They spend money. The rich buy things. Then they hold the asset forever and they leverage the asset and they never sell the asset, right? So that is part of empire rot. Mm-hmm. And it has always been part of empire rot. But one of the characteristics of what always leads to that is, it's one thing to like go out and like develop trade routes or whatever. It is the act of actually attempting to govern outside your borders, which is exactly what the United States does. It's exactly what Britain did that led up to their demise, to govern beyond your borders. Like, because you'll only expand your actual nation so much, and you'll go, okay, I'm going to fall under my own weight. So now what I need is vassal states, right, to control. And then I'll use my vassals to control their vassals and further expand and try to maybe control as much as you can. Well, that never works. And what you end up doing is you're spending so much of your treasure trying to govern outside of your borders, you're not maintaining things inside your borders. And, man, when I started doing research into, like, Native American cultures, like the ones that got big, like the Mexica, the Aztec, and the Toltecs and all, like, holy shit, the same freaking thing happened 6,000 years ago in South America and Central America that happened in Rome about the same time. Like, it's all the same pattern. And that always leads to what we're talking about today, some form of conflict within the nation, like warring factions, because everybody's losing everything. And then the YOLO thing, right? You were talking about how, like, people did crazy shit because, hey, I might get blown up tomorrow. The more you feel that way, the more you slip into depravity. That seems familiar. Like, the whole thing is such an obvious pattern. You probably feel it maybe worse than I do about it. I look at it and go, how do you not see this? And I almost feel bad teaching people to see it because it's a horrible thing to be able to look at it and go, I know exactly where this goes. It might look a little bit different as it goes there, but I know where it's going.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a number of history-related memes that I just will periodically post and repost and whatever, you know, that I might have posted like four or five times over the last few years, but it's, you know, still relevant. One of them is something like, those who study history are doomed to watch people today, you know, do the exact same mistakes as before. Like the common saying is, oh, we study the past so that we don't, you know, repeat the same mistakes. Yeah. And my view is like, no, that has never happened. People just keep doing the same, you know, mistakes over and over and over again. The details are different. The scenery is different, whatever, but it's the same broad patterns over and over again. And so it's like, no. To study history is like to find out all the dumb stuff they are going to do again. You know, probably within your lifetime. And it is interesting to think about this just kind of occurred to me when you brought up the collapse of empires, that the troubles, like specifically that phase of the conflict in Ireland, really didn't start until after the British had basically lost all their empire or most of it. You know, they had Northern Ireland still part of the UK and, like, you know, a few other little places they still controlled directly, like the Falklands or Gibraltar or whatever, but like the British Empire was basically had been gone for, you know, you could argue exactly when, but was pretty well gone by like 1972, you know, when this stuff really started escalating in Northern Ireland. So you're in a post-imperial state, whereas the US is at a different phase in the decline of empire. We're further back, you know, I would argue we're probably somewhere in the neighborhood of like where the British were in the 1930s, where on paper the British Empire was still, you know, quite impressive and, you know, was the largest it ever was in terms of like how much territory they officially, you know, claimed and whatever. But, you know, it was clearly, you know, kind of rotting from within and declining and whatever. So we're more sort of like that. And so that makes it again, like, could end up being horribly tragic, but just from a history dork point of view, interesting, like, huh, like I don't want things to escalate here, but if they did escalate into something more closely resembling the Troubles, just on a larger scale, how does the fact that we're like an empire still in decline and decay maybe change things versus in the UK in the 70s, 80s, and 90s where they were like, you know, post-imperial. They had already kind of given up. Now, they still were influenced by it, and a lot of the British military's just like overall approach to operating had been shaped by counterinsurgency operations in, you know, what we would call back then the Third World. And that influenced their how they conducted themselves in Northern Ireland. But like, yeah, how will it change that they were already kind of mostly done with empire, at least in the direct sense, when this stuff happened in, you know, their own neighborhood, whereas we're kind of like still in the process. And I mean, most Americans are still in denial that the U.S. even is an empire, let alone, you know, in denial that it's an empire in decline. Like you would first have to sell them on this idea that we are an empire. We check all the boxes for what an empire really is. And then you would have to sell them on the idea of like, and we're an empire that's like, you know, not all the way along for sure, but fairly far down the path of decline. You know, does that make things better or worse, or is it just make it messier and more complicated?
Or just inevitable, right? Like, I mean, there's really no way to know exactly how this is going to play out, but I think you and I agree that some level of internal conflict and dissolution of empire is the next stage for this country. I don't know if the Trump gambit can cause some sort of economic reboot for some, like another two-decade can kick or something. Maybe it can. I'm not going to say it can't. Mm-hmm. I know what the mythology is behind how it's going to happen. I just don't know if there's – even if he's smart enough to do what some people are saying he's going to do, I don't know if the political capability to do it exists. I mean, the guy can't fire a freaking random federal worker without some judge – some federal judge at like the lowest level of the court system getting in the way of it. How are you going to reboot the economic system without the complete cooperation of the Federal Reserve and the United States Congress and the judiciary? Right. Like, I don't know that you can do that. And even if he did, I still say it would be like, okay, there, that can full of rocks just went pretty far down the road, but it's still there. Mm-hmm. What do you think the timeline looks like?
Yeah, I mean, I think
hate that but I get to do it to somebody else for once. So,
yeah, I'm always, you know, reluctant to say that because honestly, if I was living in this country in the late 70s, I would think like, oh yeah, you know, we're
making a 90s, man.
Yeah. I mean, but you know, between, you know, what happened with Vietnam, all the, you know, social dysfunction and violence of the late 60s and into the 70s, the inflation ending the gold standard, what at the time seemed like, you know, bad deficits now seem great. You know, I would have been looking around in the late 70s and been like, oh yeah, there's no way this thing could go on another two decades. Might not even last another one decade. Like, this is just, you know, we're overextended and whatever. And then, you know, they pulled a rabbit out of their hat. You know, Paul Volcker got inflation under control. Reagan, you know, did enough good things to get the economy going pretty well for much of the 80s and 90s. And, you know, Clinton, to his credit, like, didn't do anything to screw up the economic boom of the 90s in a major way, you know, and that's when I grew up. Like, I was born in 81. So I was a kid in the 80s and a adolescent teenager in the 90s. And like, overall, those were mostly pretty good years for like middle-class Americans. The recessions that did happen during that time seem hilariously mild compared to our recent economic problems. Inflation was low for most of the 80s and 90s. You know, it was a pretty decent time. So I wouldn't have predicted that if I was somebody looking at it from the late 70s. I thought, oh, there's no way they can patch this up, you know, for more than another decade. But I mean, when you look at everything from inflation to the national debt to all these other things, you know, the unfunded liabilities, like on and on and on.
Yeah.
And then you look at, you know, they keep sending billions of dollars to Israel and Ukraine. I was just up last month a couple of times to Western North Carolina, because I had a death in the family up there, and in a lot of those mountain towns in Western North Carolina, it's still wrecked from the hurricane, like, you know, over a year ago. And some of these little poor mountain towns, like, they just flat out don't have the money to fix basic infrastructure. It's just not there. And so there's still like places where there's just some little bridge over a river. It just got wrecked by flooding and it's just still gone. And they're like, yeah, we need, you know, whatever it is, $500,000. We could rebuild that bridge. And, you know, the feds gave us like $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever. And the state maybe gave us like another few grand, or it's like, yeah, okay. We, you know, in some cases, they even have people like willing to volunteer their time, like people, you know, who work in those jobs willing to volunteer their time. It's still not enough money even just for the materials. And then you look at like how many billions they've sent to Ukraine and Israel and other places. And it's like, it's hard not to, if you're a genuine patriot, by which I mean someone who has like an organic love for this country in the sense of the land, the people, the cultures, the history, you know, who maybe doesn't love its government, and all that, but just wants to see like your fellow Americans like do well and want yourself to do well and have good lives and peace and prosperity. It's hard not to get angry when you watch these scumbags in DC just, you know, oh, Zelensky said he needs some more, you know, cruise missiles. Oh, how many billion do you need? What Netanyahu wants to do this or that. Oh, let's just fork over billions here, billions there. And then some little mountain town in North Carolina or Tennessee is like, hey, could we have a few hundred grand to fix the only bridge in town that's like still wrecked a year later? And, you know, they've been taking your tax money this whole time. And supposedly one of the things that's for is for like FEMA and disaster relief and rebuilding and whatever. And meanwhile, at least on the Republican side, a lot of the politicians who are forking the mountains of money over to foreign countries and stuff, you know, they're the ones who are saying like, oh yeah, America first. You know, let's send a few more billion to Israel and in Ukraine. America first, America first, America first. And you actually go to these places, you know, or go to a lot of the most dilapidated like Rust Belt cities and inner cities and whatever. And, you know, we'd agree that like government programs aren't the best way to fix those things. But on the other hand, it's like if the government has to spend X number of billions of dollars, what's actually going to benefit, you know, real American regular people who are not part of the political or oligarchic class? It's like, I'm sorry, I'd rather have $1 billion be spent to like fix up some of the poorest neighborhoods in Baltimore and Detroit than have that money get sent, you know, so that Zelensky can buy another mansion and, yeah, you know, the CEO of Lockheed can make another record bonus.
Yeah, durable infrastructure. How about that? Like, this is what I was saying yesterday. Like, we spent $37 trillion we didn't have. We didn't spend $37 trillion. We spent $37 trillion we didn't have. We spent other trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars that we did have, that we also now don't have. There is not much you can go and say, but now we have this. We built this thing, especially if you go, if you take the Eisenhower era backwards, where we built the international interstate system and like the remnants of that petered out through the 70s, right? Once that ended, if you go from there, like the Reagan years forward, as much as conservatives love Reagan, what can we point to that we have? And you know, people say something, well, we have like, we because of SpaceX, now we have a real space program. Okay, what do we have that a fucking mechanic in West Virginia is like, hey man, I'm glad we got that. That helps me and my family. What do we have? What assets have we created with $37 trillion of pissed away money we don't even have? What do we have to show for it? And we have nothing.
Yeah,
the government's a reflection of the people. Remember I said rich people buy things and you know, middle class to the poor spend money. The government spends money. It doesn't buy things. We don't have anything. Yeah. They fucking wrecked a bridge with a retard driving a tanker. And it's going to take them something like 15 years, maybe, to put that bridge back. It's kind of an important bridge, dude. I don't know if you know, but that bridge is, like, that's actually really an important piece of infrastructure. Can't fix it.
Yeah. And I'll even say, like, you know, you and I and probably most of the people listening, like, you know, not big fans of FDR and the New Deal.
Yeah.
But even that, I'll say, like, yeah, a lot of that was, you know, bridges to nowhere and make work. But hey, number one, at least they were making people do something for a check.
Yeah.
But secondly, like, you know, some of that was good, useful infrastructure that got built. And you could say like, oh yeah, if the government wasn't involved, maybe it would have been done more efficiently or been done in ways that were, but okay, fair enough. I'd agree with you as a theoretical debate, but like, you know, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Hoover Dam, you know, some of the highway projects from the 30s even, and bridges and whatever like that, some of the national park, you know, infrastructure that was built as part of the make work programs of the 30s, like, I'm sorry, I'm glad that stuff's there. You know, like the national parks is one of the things the federal government does that I hate the least.
Yes,
and exactly. You know, like when you go to a random kind of obscure national park and like there's a really nice visitor center and a really nice, you know, road system and whatever.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of times that stuff was built or at least begun in the 30s. And yeah. Like, hey, it's something that still is useful and beneficial to people today.
I've been to bunches of parks and stuff like that where I've been like, you know, these beautiful stone steps go down to a place to fish, and then there's a plaque mm-hmm. there. It was built by the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yep.
It's still there. It's almost 100 years old. We put a road in, and it's falling apart in 2 years now. Yep. And they built shit that's been there for 100 years. I mentioned Eisenhower and that, you know, that big project of building a modern interstate that was based on the German Autobahn system. That is now crumbling. It wasn't supposed to last this long. Their thought was, well, we'll build it and they'll maintain it, improve it, and expand it. And we just kept using it and using it and using it. We'd fill a pothole in with tar. You know, the I-20 down here in south of the Metroplex, you know, about 20 years ago, they had to drill a bunch of holes in it and pump a bunch of stuff underneath it because it was sinking. Because it had just been abused for so long with no upkeep. They couldn't afford to build a new one, so that was their solution. They pumped a bunch of they drilled it like every square foot there was a hole. And then they pumped concrete underneath it to stop the sinking of the highway. Right. But how many times can you do shit like that? Like, we can't afford to replace what we built in the 50s and 60s. That's in spite of the fact that we're spending like a billion times more money.
Yeah.
Like, how does a society survive that? And the answer is we don't as the society is.
Yeah. And that is sort of like classic empire in decline things where it's like previous generations built all this stuff. And then, you know, the future generations gradually start building less stuff. What they build is of less quality, and they stop, you know, either because there's no, you know, funds and resources available, or because the actual knowledge is lost in extreme cases. They don't even know how to maintain it. And so, you know, you get to a point where, like, the Romans at their peak built all these nice roads and aqueducts and, like, amazing infrastructure all over their empire. And then by the latter years of the Roman Empire, it's like, oh, yeah, we can't afford to maintain all but the biggest roads and aqueducts. The other ones, we're just going to let them slide, and hopefully the locals can figure something out, or else they're going to have to figure out how to walk really far to get their water. And then, you know, eventually it turns into ruins where people are living, you know, at the base of these columns holding up these aqueducts in the Dark Ages, and like they have no idea. Because even literacy has been lost, you know, I'm not saying we're going to get that bad, but you know, never know. But, you know, they have no idea who built the ruins that they're now like building tents under, or how it was done. They're like looking up at these columns and these aqueducts going, well, I guess like, you know, previous generations must've had really cool magic, or, you know, maybe the gods built that a long time ago. I don't know. Cause there's no way we could do that, you know? I always think of that scene in Lord of the Rings where they're in the canoes and they go by the foot of the giant statue on the river, and the foot is like way bigger than a person, just the foot. And it's like, people are just looking at that like, we don't even know who built that.
Yeah. And we have that in real life today. And there's another pattern repeating there where, like, you mainly focus on what I guess we would call recorded history. And you start digging into prehistory, like the Randall Carlson, Graham Hancock world, shit gets really interesting. And you find these like historic sites that everybody knew, like it was the so-and-sos and they were there, you know, 2500 or 2000 BC. So it's about 4,000 years old. And then you start actually looking at all the things they've dated to that, and you go, this is like, you're saying, but it'd be like saying, these rednecks built the Empire State Building? That's what you're telling me. These rednecks and these trailers living around here, they built this skyscraper that their trailers are around after New York City collapsed, because the sophistication of the site did not match the things they were dating, because the civilization collapsed and went away, and then people came back and said, I'm going to camp here. Like, that's a lot of these places, it seems like that's what happened. Like, our history is actually much more ancient than we think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I am a person that does believe that some major cataclysm around the Younger Dryas, that Hancock and Carlson, I think their theory is got a lot of weight. I'm not going to say it's true, but it's got a lot of weight behind it. It makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But then that's just the same. That's just human nature, that you grow to a size, you become complacent, and you collapse. And then somebody tries to come live on your bones, but they can't work the things that you built. They don't have the sophistication. Like some of the stones, I don't know if you've looked at some of the stuff, like some of the stonework that's like actually really similar between like Turkey, Asia, and South America with these weird curves in them. You can't fit, like there's no masonry. It's just straight dry stack cut stone. Mm. You can't fit a single piece of paper between it. It's perfect. We can't do that today. We can't build that with all our tech, and they built that shit back then. So I can definitely see rednecks around, you know, with trailers around the Empire State Building someday or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And think about, you know, that Team America built the Panama Canal just a little over a century ago, built the Panama Canal, got it done early, and I believe a little bit under budget. Does anyone think that we could build a Panama Canal today, even if we're willing to go like way over budget and take like 10 times as long? Like, just look at the big dig in Boston.
You could build the Erie Canal today, dude, right? I mean, like the upstate New York stuff and all. Like, could you build that today?
Yeah.
Let alone the, because I was stationed in Panama. That is a feat of engineering that when you look at it and you realize when it was built, you're like, how in the hell? Now, they killed the shit out of a lot of people building it, mostly from yellow fever and some other illnesses and diseases that are pretty common in the jungle pre-vaccine era. But in the end, like that, I would tell anybody, if you like to go on cruises and you can take a cruise that goes through the locks, it is freaking an amazing feat in engineering. Like you said, they built that around 1900, somewhere right around, like it's more than 100 years at this point.
Yeah, yeah. It was during Teddy Roosevelt's presidency, so in like the first few years of the 20th century.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, smaller scale versions of this that you can actually see. If you go to any large American like Rust Belt city, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Detroit, you know, Buffalo, any of these places, go and go look at some of the old buildings. And you'll see they might be like dilapidated now, fallen apart, vandalized, graffitied, homeless people and rats living in them, whatever. But it's amazing how often if you go to where the older buildings are, you know, wear a flak jacket if you need to. But you'll see that like the materials and the craftsmanship of these things that were built, you know, 100, 150 years ago. Is amazing. The masonry, the stonework, you know, even what were considered like fairly, you know, low income apartments would have like really nice workmanship and like, you know, stone carvings and whatever. And
the floor joists were like 3-inch by 8-inch freaking oak.
Yeah.
Right. Like the shanty, which was the original house on the homestead my grandfather had. The house was built around 1890 something. So the shanty, which was the original house, was probably built around the 1870s, best we could tell. And in the cellar down there, we would hang deer up. And we got a bunch of deer one year, like everybody got a deer on the same day. And we only had so many nails to hang the deer on the joists down in the cellar by the back legs. So my granddad tells me to go downstairs and slam some more nails in so we can fit all the deer up. I had to get a freaking, like a big drill like that my dad used in the coal mines, because you could not put a nail in the wood. The wood was over 100 years old. You couldn't get a nail to go into it. When you drilled it, it smoked. Mm. That's what a shack was built with in the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
My house will not be – my dad's house is still there. It's in bad shape because he's got problems and he's not taking care of it, but it's still there. My house will not be here.
Mm-hmm.
In, you know, 2125. It will not be here. There's no way this house will survive that long.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, this guitar I got on the wall right here, it's a special limited edition Fender Telecaster, one of only 300 made, and then I've modified and customized it a bit. But what's really cool about it is made of reclaimed pine.
Oh, wow.
That was taken from like a defunct furniture factory in, I don't know, Pennsylvania or something like that. And the wood is over 100 years old. And so, Fender, in 2017 made a limited run of Telecasters, Strats, and Jazzmasters out of this wood that is, like, you know, aged over 100 years old, and then they roasted it and turned it into a guitar body. And it's just awesome. Like, it looks awesome. It sounds awesome. It even has knot holes in it that you can put your finger in, like you're Thomas, you know, checking on Jesus's wounds or something. But just, you know, as an example, now it's a well-made guitar, but, you know, people who are into guitars know that, like, guitars from the 50s and early 60s on average are just better and are worth way more today than even, like, nice recent ones like that.
Cause you can't get the wood.
Yeah.
Because the wood has all grown so much more quickly, like plantation style. They said that no one will ever, like, the Stradivarius formula for the Stradivarius mm-hmm. violin. It doesn't matter how good you are. Mm-hmm. Without old growth timber, you can't make a Stradivarius. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. You can't make the sound. You can't duplicate that depth. That, like, and I don't have the ear for music that probably you have, let alone some of these, like, that are like sommeliers for music. But there's people that, like, two notes out of that that's a Stradivarius.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you can have the most, you know, convincing forgery ever. And somebody just picks it up that knows how to play and does like a couple draws of the bone. They go, nope, not it.
Mm-hmm.
Not it. Like, and I know that sounds like we're off target here, guys, but this is actually very germane to the discussion that we are living on the back of engineering that we can no longer accomplish. We have more technology, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we have better engineering. And technology is great for entertainment or going to space, but the kind of engineering we're talking about, the physical, civil-level engineering that allowed people like the Romans to make an aqueduct go for miles at a 1% grade exactly. Exactly? Like, it's still 1% today? We don't have that. And we mm-hmm. don't have the technology that your great-grandfather used when he was on a highway project in 1962 working overtime and being paid with real money. We don't have that either.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
And how do we fix it as it all breaks?
Yeah, yeah. And not only do we not have, you know, the same kind of engineers, we also don't have, like, the blue-collar skilled craftsmen in the same numbers or you know, trained and experienced to the same degree. Because, yeah, you needed the genius to, like, design the Hoover Dam, but you needed the guys, like, the stone workers and, you know, all those guys who, you know, maybe couldn't have explained to you, like, the science behind what they were doing, but they were practical, you know, smart blue-collar guys. And we've spent the last, you know, 4 or 5 decades denigrating trades and blue-collar work and things like this. And, you know, so as a result, we have, like, way more people with bachelor's and master's degrees in useless crap like history than we have guys who know how to do carpentry or do welding or whatever. I mean, we have guys who do it competently, but, like, you know, the average craftsmanship level, I don't think is the same.
No.
And of those who are still really good craftsmen of some sort or another, like, a huge percentage of them are over 75 years old now and don't have any apprentices they're training coming up.
Yeah,
you know, the sort of stuff that, like, Mike Rowe talks about all the time.
Nobody wants to, because being an apprentice means doing all the shit for, like, the first couple of years and then doing some interesting things for another few years, and then you get to do good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and we've lost that culture in America. The Japanese still have it.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the few places they still have it. Like, if you're going to be a sushi chef in Japan, you're not even going to touch anything but rice for the first year. For a year, you will touch nothing but rice. Like, that's kind of crazy to me, but I have respect for that mindset, that somebody wants to be a master at something so much, and that's what they're actually, like, part of that's a gut check. Like, is this what you really want to do with your life? Do you want to really become a master at this? Because the guy that goes through 5 years of apprenticeship in Tokyo can have an incredible life making sushi.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, and it used to be many things were like that, metal work, you know, carpentry. Have you seen any of the videos of, like, these guys that are, like, pretty good carpenters, they know their shit, and they go through, like, these new builds with just, like, a camera phone and just walk through videos of, like, a house that is, they're just about to start putting the drywall up. So you can still see the stick work and all, and they're like, okay, look at the gap here, look at the gap here, look at this is the roof, this is not even, the rafters aren't together, like, and he's like, this house is going to be a $750,000 new build, and it will be done in 4 weeks. And no one's going to fix any of this shit. Mm-hmm. And so even where it looks like you have that craftsmanship, or like, oh, we'll bring in, you know, immigrants and they'll do the work. They're doing shitty work with shitty quality material. Mm-hmm. And this is compounding. Like, this is another phenomenon that I see going on in America. I had a guy on, I can't remember his name now, from the Strong Towns Initiative. And he pointed out, as we started building houses like this, the other thing that happened is we started building subdivisions. Now, some of the decent housing was built in subdivisions in the 60s and what have you. But from about 71, shocking, forward, we started building really shit housing, low, cheap-ass plywood, MDF fiberboard, freaking cheap-ass plantation stick spruce for studs and all. And these houses pretty much start to completely fall apart at about 20 years. The house isn't gone. You can fix it up. But that's where, like, everything's going to shit at the same time and everything needs fixing. Mm-hmm. But we also built all the houses within a couple years of each other. We take a bulldozer, we go in, we level an area, we put in streets, we put in infrastructure, and we develop a whole subdivision in 2 to 3 years, which means 20 years later, all the houses are going to start completely going to shit at exactly the same time. The person that bought it, that did well with it, they're smart enough to know that's going to happen. In about 15 years, they capture the equity, they sell, they move to a new house. Guy comes in buying his starter home, buys that house. In 5 to 6, 7 years, his house is falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens in entire neighborhoods at the same time. And replacing those is impossible economically today. Like, here's a, this is crazy. This is something I learned from him. And you know, we want to die. That's what it is. We want to die as a civilization. We have made a decision to die as a civilization because short-term profits are more important than existence, right?
Mm-hmm.
It will cost about $1 million to put the cul-de-sac in a subdivision. Because of the amount of concrete and blacktop and the amount of reinforcement it needs, because by code in almost every place now in America, whatever the biggest fire truck is that's made, doesn't matter if the county or the city owns one, the biggest fire truck made must be able to pull into a cul-de-sac and turn around without backing up. Okay, you just want your civilization gone. Like, you're going to put $1 million into a cul-de-sac and you're going to build 10 houses on that street. The developer will never get the money out of the cul-de-sac, let alone the houses.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we have more housing starts? And then the counties come in and say, well, we have, now they have, they will say, even where you have no building restrictions, they have one, minimum square footage.
Mm.
Most of the places around here, 1,850 square feet for a new build.
Mm.
So there's no more 1,500, 1,400, 1,250 foot starter homes being built. Over in Johnson County, just over here from me, dude, 2,500 square feet for a new build.
Huh.
You can't get an exception, exemption, nothing. You could buy a farm field and want to build a little house in the middle of it. That's the one restriction they have. You have got to have 2,500 square feet under the name of protecting property values.
Huh.
We are destroying everything that made this country successful. Everything. And other countries aren't doing that. Like, now, if you look at China, I'm not saying that their form of government's good, but they know how to build some shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, weirdly, one of the countries that, like, there's a lot of other things I'd criticize their government for, but one of the countries that's pretty good on this whole, like, idea of actually, like, building real useful infrastructure and whatever, is France. And France, I think, gets all or almost all their power from, like, you know, clean, safe nuclear energy.
Yep.
And, you know, they have lots of nuclear plants that have been built in, like, recent years that are, you know, state of the art, safe as you can get. And so, like, they're, even if there's a global energy crisis, they're still going to have power that they can afford. Whereas, like, have any nuclear power plants been built in the U.S. since, like, the 70s, you know? And a lot of the ones that were built back then have been shut down since then. And you know, what's really funny is to compare France versus Germany in that regard, because France has just, you know, gone all in on nuclear and everything like that. And Germany hasn't. Germany did the opposite.
They tore down their nuclear plants.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, there's two countries right next to each other, right? And, you know, again, France has all kinds of, you know, problems and whatever. I'm not saying they're great, but at least they're more rational on this issue. And, you know, the average French person is probably very happy that they can, like, afford to have, you know, electricity a lot easier than the German living, you know, right over the imaginary line next door.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you think people should do in their lives right now, man? Like, we gave a pretty bleak forecast here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the basic prepper, you know, type of advice that you give, like not the crazy, deranged, you know, build a fallout shelter and live in it just in case kind of advice, but the more kind of like rational modern survival type stuff, you know, that's good advice in general. But especially when, you know, times are getting increasingly interesting. And then beyond that, I mean, if you're any kind of like a public figure, or commentator or content producer, like I would just urge you as much as possible to try to really have a de-escalating and calming influence as much as you can. Like I understand getting angry when, mm-hmm. when bad people and bad groups do bad things, when the government does something bad, when whatever, I understand getting angry, but at the same time, like, the more these things escalate in the war of words, the more they're going to escalate eventually in real life. And I'm not advocating any kind of censorship or anything like that.
No, I got you.
And I'm not advocating the woke idea that, like, you know, the other side's words are violence, but my violence is words. I'm not saying that at all. But just in general, have a mindset of, like, this is very serious. It's very dangerous. Again, that Pandora's box of chaos, you don't know where it can go. And so for sure, don't be quick to advocate, like, you know, going out there and doing anything. I'm not saying don't defend yourself or anything like that. But, you know, try to not feed into just escalating things. Be very skeptical about anything that you see or hear in the media, regardless of who it's coming from, even if it's coming from a source that you're normally sympathetic to. You know, always just be kind of skeptical, even if you think it's true. Be extra skeptical if it's something that, like, seems to line up with your own personal, you know, preferences or prejudices. And then also be very careful about where you go and who and what you get involved with. You know, I am not interested in going to any protests of any group right now, because there's just too many things that can happen. Genuine, organic, you know, violence can easily happen and escalate. There's also the possibility of feds, COINTELPRO, agents provocateur, all that stuff. So you might go to some group, whatever your politics are, you might go to some protest thinking like, oh yeah, I'm totally in alignment with what this group wants, and they're all about, you know, nonviolent protests and political action and whatever. And you go there, and then, you know, again, the violence could be genuine and organic that just happens between people, you know, on the street, or it could be orchestrated from people who think they're going to benefit from escalating things and from the chaos. So stay away from those types of events. You know, there's possibility for more random stuff, like Charlie Kirk obviously got targeted regardless of what actually, you know, was behind that. He obviously got targeted because he's a super famous guy that, you know, mm-hmm. most people who are heavily into politics knew. But, you know, who's to say there's not going to be more random stuff against just average people at political events and protests and things, you know? And just in general, be careful about what you do and what you say. And again, I'm not advocating censorship. I am advocating a little bit of self-censorship. What I mean by that is, just be careful for your own sake and your own safety and potentially your own freedom. Be careful what you say and how you say it in, like, public forums, you know, online, or even like the direct messaging in most social media apps and things. Because you could easily say something or write something you absolutely do not intend to be a call to violence or justifying violence or whatever, but it could come across that way, especially if it's taken out of context, or, you know, it could even be outright, you know, doctored or whatever. But even if they take something you wrote on social media and don't alter it, but it's just something that could be interpreted reasonably as a call to violence. Like, you know, again, I'm not saying don't be angry about something that deserves to be angry about, or don't express your opinions openly and honestly, but basically don't give Big Brother a stick to beat you with. Like, don't make it easy for, if they want to come get you for something you're not involved with or don't want anything to do with, don't help make it easier for them by posting a bunch of crap that sounds like you're calling for violence or whatever. And also, don't gloat. if and when someone that you know, really don't like,
if someone on the other side gets the Charlie Kirk treatment, don't make a video of yourself going, aha, right? Like, yeah. A bunch of people just did and found out they F-A'd and F-O'd real hard.
Yeah, and there can be a lot of things that can happen from doing that sort of thing. Like, it might not just be like you lose your job or, you lose a lot of your following or whatever. Potentially, if things get more authoritarian in terms of the police state, like, that they could, you know, just look at where the UK is as far as, like, your potential to be arrested for just saying something a little bit too extreme on social media, even if there's no direct call to violence or anything. That could escalate regardless of who's in power. Like, Trump is already escalating it, you know, from his side, with all the Palantir stuff and all the, you know, kind of, war on terror type stuff he's pushing. But, like, you know, when Biden was in or some future Democrats in, they're going to push it on their side. But all those tools are going to be there for the next person. And the next person might be someone who you don't like, even if you like the person who's in charge of that today. Plus, again, you've got this issue of it's so complicated because, yeah, Trump might want to use all these surveillance and police state powers to go after, you know, the far left. But not everybody who's running those agencies, even under Trump, is going to agree with that. And they still are going to have some ability to kind of do their own thing, whether the president wants them to or not. So just be careful. Be careful across the board, you know, where you go and what you say, you know, publicly or anything like that. And, you know, anything you can possibly do to, like, de-escalate, if you have any kind of, like, a public following or anything like that, you know, I think is to the good. It's to the good. Like, you know, I hope it still doesn't happen, but I was happy that, like, no right wingers in the immediate aftermath of Charlie Kirk went out there and, like, you know, assassinated Rosie O'Donnell or, you know, whoever it might be, you know, Nancy Pelosi. I don't know, just, you know, pick your Democrat politician or media figure. And I'm no fan of those people, you know, but, like, them getting assassinated would be very bad for everybody. So, you know, don't. Be restrained, be willing to defend yourself, but also be restrained in what you say and what you do.
I would add to it everything you said, and then try to live not in a city.
Oh,
just try to live not in a city. Like, and when I say not in a city, I mean, like, the suburb of the city where you can open the side window if you have one and spit really hard and hit your neighbor's wall. That's probably not good either. It may not be as bad as, like, downtown, but history has shown us where people riot when they riot, and they riot where all the stuff is. And they don't riot where there's not a lot of stuff. Like, it's a risk reward ratio. I can get a big screen TV and probably not shot, or I can maybe find something and definitely get shot at. Right. And, like, this is not, like, country boy bravado. It's reality. Like, if you did start rioting around here, I can tell you, I know my neighbors enough to know the only one that won't shoot you is the old lady lives next door to me. But she'll make a phone call to four different people who she knows will shoot you. Right. Like, that's, and again, it's not country boy bravado. It's just reality. And that, you know, there is something to that. And they know what they can get away with in the inner cities. And that's, if you notice, like, when Trump won the first time, where did they riot? Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, L.A., even here in Texas, Austin, nowhere near as bad as the West Coast. But they rioted in all the places that voted for freaking Clinton. They rioted in the places that were on their side. That's still where they're, because that's where they could. They get the most attention, the less likely to be shot, and the highest amount of stuff they can damage and steal. And stay away from those places as a matter of course. Like, and I think if you run a business or something, you have to be in, like, have a contingency to where you can remotely run your business for a week or two. If there's any way, man, don't. There's no good that comes from cities anymore. I hate to say it, but it's true. There's just no good there. Yeah. Might be a good place to go have dinner, but that's about it, man.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I would agree with that for sure. Yeah. City. I mean, I've never liked cities. I don't even really like visiting cities most of the time, unless there's, like, something really cool there I want to see or do. But yeah, certainly in troubling times, whether that's for economic reasons or for kind of like, you know, social political warfare reasons or both. It's very much like you don't even want to visit a city because you just don't know when stuff might pop off.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and wrap up because we're well over 2 hours now, which is typical when you and I get together. But tell people how they can learn more about you, subscribe to your podcast and stuff like that.
Yeah, so if you just type in dangeroushistorypodcast.com, you'll get to my website. You can also just search for Dangerous History or Dangerous History Podcast wherever you like to consume your audio podcasts. And also my Patreon. It helps keep me going on this thing, but it also gives you hundreds of hours of material that's not available to the general public of Dangerous History. So it's patreon.com/ProfCJ, P-R-O-F-C-J, and that'll get you there, and you can sign up and get all kinds of cool stuff that you can't get anywhere else.
Well, CJ, man, thanks for joining us again today.
Jack, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, guys, real quick before I go, I just want to remind you one of the ways you can help support this show and the work that we do, start your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. If you start your shopping there, no matter what you buy, you will help us out. No matter what it is, but you'll also find all the items I've reviewed. My item of the day, I keep bringing it back around because it's such a dadgone good deal. And it is Anker's V20i open ear headphones. I don't know how these things are still for sale at $25 a pair. The retail on them is more like $60. They are fantastic. They have the ear loops where they don't fall out of your ear into a duck shit pond. Ask me how I know that can happen. And it is something weird with, like, specifically my left ear. Any of the earbuds that you put inside your ear without the loop, they fall out and I lose them. Run them over with a tractor, who drop them in the deep leaves in the forest on a walk, whatever, and you can't find them and they're gone. These don't do that. They have great sound and they don't fall out of your head. I think it's very clear that this is a discontinued item at this point for Anker. That's why it's still being sold at such a low price. When they do low prices like this, it's usually a quick drop. They do it for a couple of weeks, and then it's gone. When they discontinue an item, they pretty much drop that price until they liquidate that inventory so that they don't cannibalize their sale of a new product. There's nothing wrong with these things, man. $25, buy an extra set. I did, because sooner or later, I'll just lose the damn case or something. But I like to listen to podcasts. I like to listen to music. Sometimes my wife and I are doing things on the couch, and we're both listening to our own thing, and that prevents, like, flooding over on sound. They're just a great tool. And, hey, Christmas is coming. It's not far away. Anybody would love a set of these, and it's only $25. So, you know, that friend of yours or that family member you like and you kind of want to give them some, but you don't like them that much, hey, $24.95, and you're done for the Christmas season. Of course, the other thing is you can pick up a copy of my book, Laws of Life by Jack Spirko, available at Amazon. Just search for Laws of Life, and you'll find it. And, the other thing you can do is become a member. Become a member of my member support brigade. Get all the great discounts. Your membership makes you a profit. With that, I'm going to wrap up. Tomorrow we'll have an expert counsel Q&A that will end the week. And then next week will be 100% rewinds because I have the workshop going on here all week long. So I'm going to have like 85 people descend on my little 3-acre homestead. So I just can't do new shows then. So I've got some great rewinds picked out for you. Then we'll be back to our regularly scheduled program rolling all the way up to Thanksgiving. Take care, guys, and have a great day.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.